The views expressed on this podcast are those of the participants, not of Reuters News.
I think everyone should be cognizant of the rise of Shein and indeed the Me Too models that are coming fast behind Shein. And it really, if we hark back to sort of 10 years ago, it reminds me of the grocery debate. So, you know, 10 years ago, people thought the German discounters were in a different market to the mainstream grocers. But actually, of course, they're not. And they take the share and they improve their offer and they continually go after the mid-market. And that's what we're seeing in apparel as well.
That was Matt Clark, EMEA leader for retail at Alex Partners. I caught up with him last week to discuss the challenges facing traditional retailers like Zara owner Inditex and H&M, and the opportunities for aggressive upstarts like ultra-cheap fast fashion retailer Shein. Welcome to The Exchange, a weekly podcast from Reuters Breaking Views that explores the big questions on the minds of business leaders, policymakers, and experts from around the world. I'm your host, Amy Donlan, and I'm coming to you from London. Shein is striking awe and fear into the retail market. Its technology-led business model allows it to sell clothes for a fraction of what its rivals charge, and it's particularly popular with Gen Z women, a customer base that will become the future shopper of most brands. For now, larger retailers are dismissing the risk of Shein, and they don't reckon it can steal their market dominance. But that approach may look foolish if the retailer improves its quality and starts to appeal to larger audiences. Clark reckons there are things established retailers can learn from Shein and other newer retailers. Stay tuned to hear our fascinating conversation. And if you've any comments, please rate us or leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. Matt, it's lovely to have you on The Exchange.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So Matt, we bumped into each other at the World Retail Congress in Paris, an annual shindig of all the retail people, CEOs and all sorts of experts on retail. So I thought it'd be great to talk to you about lots of different things. But I suppose to start off, retail has been through quite a bumpy patch over the past few years. There was obviously the pandemic, there's been inflation. So I just, as a very kind of broad opener, I wondered if you could tell me what are your thoughts on the health of the retail market? So maybe more specifically, looking really at kind of apparel, looking at the kind of the big, the Inditexes, the LVMHs, the Sheins of the world. How do you think that market is?
Yeah, I think annual shindig is one way of putting it. It's more like an annual therapy session, largely because of what you just said. It's not been a great few months or indeed few years for the apparel industry in particular. The food industry, very, very different. But the winter we've just been through, and after all the disruption, of course, through the pandemic and then the economic crises that we face since then, have made for a pretty rocky ride for most apparel retailers. Now, it's very different depending on the part of apparel you're in, of course. So up until recently, the luxury sector has been largely immune because the luxury consumer has still been very willing to spend. But even that now has started to hit decline, and you'll have seen Kering's results that came out earlier today, which announced a profit decline. So even luxury is now struggling somewhat. The value sector has been the most buoyant for obvious reasons, with economic pressure on consumers driving people towards that sector and trading down. And of course, the rise of the likes of Shein and the incredible growth that they have experienced over the last few years has really disrupted the sort of core fast fashion online players, with the sort of more traditional Zalando's, ASOS's, Boohoo's of the world, so having to react to that new competitive threat, but still benefiting to some extent from people trading into that value sector, but also struggling with the response of people going back to stores. The bit that's been really challenged has been the mid-market, of course, and the muddle in the middle that we observe in apparel has just increased, and you've seen more and more businesses being restructured or failing, being bought up. And the rise of the multi-platform, multi banner platform players, both the strategics like Next and Frasers, and also the sort of IPCO, OPCO brand licensing models such as Authentic and WHP, has kind of accelerated over the last few years. So this consolidation, restructuring of the market has continued, and we expect it to continue further over the next years.
And what do you think? I mean, I suppose I just want to start off maybe with your thoughts on luxury, because as you said, on the day of this conference, this annual therapy session, it was clear that LVMH, you know, was not as strong as people had hoped it would be. Superdry was in restructuring. I'm just sort of curious, what do you think the state of the luxury space is? As in, do you think that the sort of the carings or the difficulties that we're seeing within certain brands, do you think that is temporary, or do you think that this is just the beginning of a sort of more a trickier time for them, which I think we've seen, as you say, in the mid-market?
Yeah, I think it is more temporary. If I'm honest, but it's just a reflection of the fact that even the sort of wealthier consumers, and particularly with, changes in how people travel, and obviously in the UK specifically with tax-free shopping, has had an impact on the luxury players. So, I mean, the UK is a very specific example where tax-free shopping has a big impact on how luxury is doing. But of course, the LVMHs and Kerings of the world are only slightly dependent on the UK market, and they generally pick up the slack because people who are buying will go to Paris or Milan or wherever to buy their luxury goods. But the overall sort of pressure on the wallet and the squeeze on discretionary spend has even hit the sort of super wealthy customer that is the main luxury customer, particularly not the sort of very high end of luxury so much, because that's still fairly resilient, but the sort of entry-level luxury consumer is definitely feeling the pinch. So that's what we're seeing is occurring over the last sort of year or so. As was discussed many times at the conference last week, the sort of light is starting to appear at the end of the tunnel for consumer confidence returning, and people expect it to start to lift through this year, but really only come back towards the end of the year and into next year. And there is this cautious sense of optimism. So you would expect, as that, assuming that does happen, and of course the one thing we've learned over the last few years is making predictions is a fool's game in terms of economic performance. But assuming that does happen, you would expect luxury to recover, because it's not like the luxury trend or the predisposition for luxury is likely to change, certainly not in the short term.
Mm. And there is, as you say, there is one segment of retail that is proving extremely resilient. And as you said, it's fairly obvious why. So that's the Primarks and the Sheins of the world, offering, ultra cheap clothing and accessories to really like a very young audience. I suppose the question that I sort of am curious about when I look at Shein is, Inditex is 150 billion euro. Fast fashion brand that has really been, it's very difficult to compete with it. I mean, H&M has proven that. But I'm curious, if you're the CEO of Inditex, should you be worried about the rise of Shein?
I think everyone should be cognizant of the rise of Shein, and indeed the Me Too models that are coming fast behind Shein. And it really, if we hark back to sort of 10 years ago, it reminds me of the grocery debate. So, 10 years ago, people thought the German discounters were in a different market to the mainstream grocers. But actually, of course, they're not. And they take the share and they improve their offer and they continually go after the mid-market. And that's what we're seeing in apparel as well. And the consumer continues to be ever more fickle on brands, but also more willing to trade down and have some very cheap basic items, as well as some more expensive items from a perhaps more premium brand. So I think it is all one market, and whilst the sort of really high end premium brands will certainly feel they don't really compete directly with the likes of Shein. I think the reality is, particularly for the younger generations, that there's much more sort of one market perspective, if that makes sense. So I think from a couple of reasons, there is that competitive element, but also the way that Shein uses technology to drive their, you know, in many ways, just transform and turn on the head the way that retail is run through the use of data and technology is something that every apparel retailer should take note of and, where possible, adopt some of those techniques to help them be more agile, to manage inventory better, to be closer to the customer, particularly as things like social shopping gain more and more traction, and the younger generations who spend, you know, a good portion of their time on social media will end up shopping there. And that, and some of the things we were talking about at the WRC, you know, we expect social shopping to be an $8.5 trillion channel in 5-6 years time, which is, you know, on the way to being quarter of the world's commerce. So if that prediction is true, then that is a channel that's currently about 1.3 trillion. So it's growing at a phenomenal rate. And of course, apparel in particular is often sold in that channel. So there is a real need for anyone who's in the fashion apparel market to be on top of these trends. And the likes of Shein are driving these trends because that's the channel they're particularly good at selling through. So I think there's reasons to notice them, even if you think you don't compete directly with them, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so much to unpick there, actually. I want to pick you up on a few things, but I really think that that is such an interesting analogy about the grocers, you know, the big grocers when Lidl and Aldi came along. And I do remember that the talk of the time was that the big supermarkets had nothing to worry about. They were higher value, you know, the products they were selling were better valued. They had relationships with customers, and customers were loyal to the brand, whichever grocer that it was. And that if you went into one of those German discounters, you would soon see that it wasn't a pleasant experience. It was cheap stuff. And I think that, you know, you and I talked about this, that really Aldi and Lidl, you know, changed quickly and recognized what customers wanted and are really quite a big threat to a lot of the big grocers now. And I just wondered that very same argument I was hearing an awful lot about Shein, that the quality was a problem, that actually once you try it, you'll always go back to Zara or H&M or Massimo Dutti or whichever brand you like, because you'll realize that actually you're willing to spend a bit more to have a nice item. And I'm sort of curious whether you think that is the path that Shein will follow as well, that they actually will get better at being cheap.
I think they certainly will adapt their proposition. And you know, speaking with Peter from Shein last week, you know, he was open and admitting obviously they have had quality issues, but they are working on it, right? So both the quality will improve over time because they need to improve it to ensure they don't let their customers down. But also their proposition will improve over time. So as you say, one of the things that Aldi and Lidl have done very successfully is adapt the range and the proposition to the countries they're in. So it isn't, you know, like walking into, you know, a part of Germany when you go into their stores. It's very much feels far more, if you're in the UK, British, and a lot of more local products and a lot more tailoring to the needs of consumers that are being served. And that level of sophistication is really now ramping up as the discounters continue to take market share and go after the mid-market. So that the equivalent of that, which we're already seeing from Shein, is not only the sort of core product that they manufacture themselves under their own label, but also the marketplaces they're standing up. So in the US, the marketplace has been launched, and they're starting to buy up brands. So, you know, Misguided in the UK. There's a whole bunch of things that they're doing to evolve their proposition at enormous pace that will just start to make it more and more attractive to the consumers in the 165 countries that they serve. Great statistic, though, which is certainly not something I'd realised, is that, you know, Shein's success is entirely dependent on countries outside of China. They don't sell within China. So all of their revenue, all of their growth is coming from outside of China, and they just manufacture in China. So, you know, that there's an amazing story there of how you can grow and use technology to grow and scale platforms at incredible pace.
And I'm curious as well, Matt, if you could tell us just a little bit more about how others could replicate the technology that they're using. I mean, you mentioned, you know, the sort of the social shopping, which for some of our listeners who aren't really aware of what that is, I think that's the idea essentially that, you know, brands can go on, you know, whether it's Instagram or Facebook, and they basically showcase their wares, and it's people wearing them, right? It's live, and you can buy them then through their site. Would that be a fair kind of characterization of it?
Exactly. And you know, whether it's influencer led or it's more transactional, but on social media channels and the ability to click directly through and transact either actually while you're on that social media platform or by transferring into the brand website. Yeah, that's a huge trend and increasing, let's say, already 1.3 trillion this year or last year, but expected to grow phenomenally for obvious reasons, because people are spending so much more time on social media, and it's the equivalent of footfall effectively. So people aren't going to stores so much, but they are spending time on social media, so it's the obvious place to go. And things like Google's circle to search technology will really enable some of these trends, because if you see an item, even if it's not on a brand's website, and you circle it, the Google algorithm will then take you to a number of those items which are similar in look and feel. So these kind of technologies that are now becoming much more commonplace will really increase the level of trade that goes through that channel.
Interesting. So one thing as well that I think that, Matt, a lot of people were talking to me about behind the scenes, CEOs and others, was about how interested governments are at the moment on waste, on whether that's fashion waste or just, you know, general household retailers and what they sell, and just where things are going, how long people are, you know, keeping their items for, how much of the stuff is actually just destroyed because they don't sell it and it's excess inventory. I'm sort of curious, how worried do you think fashion retailers should be about regulation? Do you think that this is actually something that, you know, governments or regulators could become coordinated and apply, whether it be taxes or levies or whatever it is, onto the industry to force improvements in recycling or just to deter them, you know, selling too much stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very live issue. I was with a CEO of a big online fashion player earlier today, actually, and we were having the same conversation. And I mean, he was saying that he feels it's inevitable that some kind of regulation will come. However, the nature of that regulation and how broad it's applied is completely up in the air at the moment. So the regulators across all the different governments haven't got to the stage where they have a clear view on, are they just going to go after the Sheins, the big Chinese companies of the world? Are they going to apply it to homegrown companies as well? What the level is? What is it, just online? Is it in stores as well? You know, all of that is still very much a massive debate. But as we heard in Paris, you know, the focus, and actually particularly in the French press, on the need to regulate against fast fashion, very cheap fast fashion, to drive waste down is a very loud voice, and it is influencing governments. But it's quite a difficult one for governments to enact, partly because of the complexity, but also because if you put, I don't know, say €5 an item on a fast fashion item being imported, you're annoying quite a lot of your voters. So this is not a straightforward debate, but it's certainly a very live debate, and you would expect that to result in some kind of regulation, some kind of tax of some description at some point. But it feels like something that's not going to happen tomorrow, because the complexities and the different opinions obviously will mean that's going to be quite a long process.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's interesting as well. I mean, something that I found very interesting listening to somebody from Shein talking on one of the panels was that, you know, the idea that it's really Gen Z shoppers that go to their site, it's women. And actually, these are the people who in surveys say they're most concerned about the environment and really, you know, do their best to, you know, keep an eye on their carbon footprint. So I think that that's quite interesting as well. And again, it seems like a massive question or issue for brands is how do they attract this Gen Z shopper? And again, I wonder, do you think that there are any, you know, retailers or brands that are actually particularly good at that at the moment?
Well, I think there's a couple of things in there. I think the sort of learned experience of the entire industry is that the desire for ESG friendly retail, if you like, has a much bigger share of voice than it does share of wallet. So in the majority of cases, and Gen Z in particular, you know, value trumps values when it comes to shopping, you know, assuming you agree that fast fashion is generally not great for the environment. So that is obviously means that you can't really rely on consumers, with the exception of the demographic that will probably be listening to this podcast. You know, you can't really rely on consumers to make choices which mean that they will actively pursue higher quality, longer lasting items when, you know, fashion and value really is what drives most purchase decisions. So companies have to take the lead. And back to the previous point, companies really need to collaborate to take the lead. Otherwise, regulators who may not be very well informed will impose rules and restrictions, which may not actually be the right answer. Mm. So there is a real imperative across, particularly the apparel industry, because it's so, you know, much in focus here and has, you know, biggest carbon footprint, etc., and all of the social issues associated with the fashion industry. Real imperative there for that industry to help influence the regulators and get the right outcome in terms of the right balance between the right social and environmental approaches to drive down waste and you know, tackle the climate and the social agendas. Mm-hmm. Now, who's doing this really well? Well, I think everybody is doing something. And you know, even, you know, the big the H&Ms and Zara's of the world, of course, all have pre-loved programs. They all are doing their bit to encourage recycling and reuse, etc. And even, you know, Shein were talking last week about how they use technology to help reduce waste, and they sample their clothing lines so that they don't over manufacture, so they haven't got waste inventory and things like that. So everyone has an approach to this, and it'd be difficult to say who's brilliant at it and who isn't. I think the interesting thing is, and we heard from ThredUp last week, but the platforms that are actively, you know, encouraging recycling, so Vinted, Depop, ThredUp, etc., RealReal, these platforms have become enormously popular, clearly. And is, you know, we were talking about that channel reaching 350 billion in sales by 2027. So it's a significant channel. Now, the really interesting thing about all of that is, of course, that again is taking away from cash from the rest of the apparel industry. So if you think about all of the disruption that's being faced, and this is why the muddle in the middle is now such a challenged place, is you've got not only like newish players like Shein rising up, but you've also got the whole pre-loved agenda advancing at pace, which is, of course, people aren't buying more apparel, they're just buying it in different ways. Yeah. So all of that has to come into the mix when you consider what's going on in the industry.
So Matt, I think maybe just as like a last question, I mean, what we've discussed here, as we said, is, you know, the lead up to where we are now was very tricky. The customer is very discerning, very cost conscious. It's possible that there is regulation coming down the line that could make it more difficult to really sell as many things as you possibly can. So I wondered if you think of a retailer, a fashion retailer, and think if they had lots of money, what would you advise them to do to prepare for this future? What do you think would be a good investment at this stage?
Finding a fashion retailer with lots of money would be quite tricky, but let's go for a hypothetical on that. And I think what we observe is, obviously, the answer to that will be in part investment in data analytics, AI technology, etc., of course. And actually, one of the big issues that we see in the industry is that most retailers have got an enormous amount of technical debt. So the core technology systems, the kind of the ERP systems, etc., are underinvested. So there's quite a lot of money to spend on just getting the basics right. But you've got to balance that with investing in advanced analytics and in new tools and techniques to manage inventory better, to get to know your customers better, personalization, all of those things across the value chain, which will help stay relevant to your customer and run the business more effectively. But the thing that you know, people tend to forget, and it was definitely quite absent from the discussion at the World Retail Congress last week, was, you know, you've got to do all of that. You've got to do all of the clever stuff with technology, with managing inventory, with running a business better, but you still got to get amazing product designed and created and in front of the customers in the right way. So, you know, just I think the balance is somewhat off in terms of, again, the way that these issues are voiced, because everyone's, you know, really keen to talk about what does Gen AI do? How can we build a retail media business? How do we take advantage of the social selling channel? All of which are, of course, important things to get right, but can't forget that investing in the right people, in the right techniques to generate great products, and investing in the right content to get the right marketing messages out there and support your brand messaging. Some of that is still the big point of difference for most brands, most fashion retailers. So this, the biggest challenge for retail leaders at the moment is actually where to focus. So there's so many things. This is why the industry, I think, you know, taking a glass half full view, is actually so exciting. There are so many things you could do. The hardest thing for retail leaders is working out what you should do. And actually that prioritization and determining where you invest, and this balance between products, channel, customer engagement, all the things that you can do as a retailer or as a brand, you know, that's the hard bit. Where do you take the trade-offs? Where do you invest? Where do you place your bets? How do you keep the core business going as you start new channels? You know, all of that, that's what makes it so exciting and so dynamic, and why you would expect to see, you know, more consolidation, more disruption, and more new exciting companies coming into the mix as we go through the next few years.
Very interesting. Matt, fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in. This podcast was produced by Oliver Tashlich in London. Subscribe to The Exchange and our sister podcast, The Views Room, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. Catch up with our latest views and much more on breakingviews.com and on X, where our handle is @breakingviews.
I'm Kim Vanell. Join me every morning for a roundup of what's happening at home and around the world. From the front line in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
To the heart of US politics.
When Trump said that he expected to be arrested, it seems like he was trying to get ahead of the story.
We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes. For your essential daily briefing, follow Reuters World News wherever you get your podcasts.